Noam Chomsky talks about where we go from here, and Ruckus Society's John Sellers on the latest round of protest trials after Philadelphia and the Republican convention. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli soldiers have killed more Palestinians in the occupied territories. Yesterday, another four Palestinians were killed on a day when Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak announced he's pausing the so-called peace process. Their deaths bring to 132 the number of people killed in 3 weeks of clashes, mainly involving Palestinian youth throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers who retaliate with tear gas, rubber-coated bullets, or live rounds. Close to 4,000 people, overwhelmingly Palestinian, have been injured. With Barak calling a time out from the 7-year peace process, and with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat telling him to go to hell and declaring that the intifada, or uprising against Israel, will continue, prospects for any immediate de-escalation of the bloodletting look grim. Sunday's toll brought the number of Palestinians killed since Friday alone to 18, half of them gunned down by Israeli soldiers on Friday, one of the heaviest days of bloodshed since the violence began after right-wing Israeli leader Ariel Sharon went to the Temple Mount. And this news from Lima: Peru's former intelligence chief, Vladimiro Montesinos, has left Panama, apparently to head home, sparing Panama a tough decision on an asylum request, but creating major problems in Peru. Local radio stations reported that a plane matching the description of the one carrying Montesinos landed in a military base, a town miles south of Lima, this morning after stopping in Ecuador. As Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori's spy chief and closest advisor, Montesinos was viewed by many as the most powerful man in Peru. Montesinos is free to return to Peru because there are no charges pending against him, but his presence, quote, could damage the political environment, said the prime minister. The flight comes just as the government proposed a sweeping amnesty. As Montesinos was flying to Ecuador late yesterday, the Peruvian government unveiled a sweeping amnesty plan for human rights violators in Peru. Opposition legislators had accused the government of trying to blackmail them into accepting the amnesty in exchange for agreeing to new elections. This news from Paris: several hundred European politicians, lawmakers, and international activists gathered in Paris this weekend to urge the United States to abolish the death penalty. Participants called on Europeans to sign a petition intended for the incoming American president. Organizers of the French-based movement called the Group Against the Death Penalty in the United States said they hoped to get 1 million signatures before sending the petition to Washington in time for the presidential inauguration. The French National Assembly president called the death penalty, quote, a stain on the largest democracy in the world. Opposition to the death penalty is unanimous among European governments, and U.S. debate on the subject has intensified in recent months. This news from Germany: thousands of Germans joined together this weekend in protest against foreigner hate and the extreme right, setting a sign of opposition ahead of an expected neo-Nazi demonstration in the German western city of Dortmund. Counter-demonstrations against rightist events are common in Germany, but the events have taken on a more urgent tone because of a recent wave of awareness of hate-fueled violence that followed a still-unsolved bomb attack late in July in Dusseldorf. That attack left 10 recent immigrants injured, at least 6 of them Jews, and at least 3 people were killed in other hate attacks over the summer. In the latest attack Friday night, an Algerian asylum seeker was stabbed in the arm following an argument about Germans and foreigners with 2 men. Dortmund authorities had tried to ban the neo-Nazi march planned for late Saturday, but a court late Friday evening ruled that it could go on. This news from Los Angeles. Three people were arrested and rubber bullets were fired at hundreds of marchers protesting police brutality. Protesters who rallied at police headquarters yesterday said officers fired at them as they attempted to walk around Parker Center before beginning the rally. More than 200 police officers, some in riot gear, some on horseback, surrounded about 1,500 people who shouted at them and raised their fists while listening to speakers whose loved ones were killed or injured in police conflicts. Alleged corruption in LAPD's Rampart Station was a key topic at the demonstration. In more than 50 cities around the country, protests were held yesterday around the Stolen Lives Project, lives stolen, the activists say, by police who killed their loved ones. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. Over the weekend, thousands of people protested in South Korea around an international summit that was taking place. Asian and European presidents, prime ministers, and officials gathered there with 10,000 protesters, again dealing with the issue of globalization. Today, we're going to take up that issue with MIT professor Noam Chomsky. He's a professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he has long been a political analyst and social critic, author of many books. He gave this speech just months ago at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland.
Let's begin with the term globalization. It's conventionally used now to refer to a very specific form of international integration of international society that's been proceeding for about 25 years, extending, recapitulating traditional patterns, but with some important changes as well. The process is sometimes described as a kind of force of nature. There is no alternative. Tina, Maggie Thatcher's famous phrase. Those slogans are convenient for the beneficiaries of the process, but they don't even have the merit of the ritualistic incantations of Marx's iron laws of history, and they can be dismissed. There are many choices available within the existing framework of institutions, and the institutions are no more immutable now than they've ever been throughout history. At every point, we can ask why certain specific choices are made, whether they are the paths that should be chosen, or whether they should then be followed or altered or maybe quite drastically modified. In the past year, the global issues have very largely been framed in terms of sovereignty, meaning the rights of political entities to follow their own course, maybe benign, maybe ugly, and to do so free from external interference. In the real world, external interference means interference by highly concentrated power, the major center, of course, in the United States. Concentrated global power is called by various names, depending on which aspect of the problems of sovereignty and freedom we have in mind. So sometimes it's called the Washington Consensus or the Wall Street Treasury Complex, Jagdish Bhagwati's phrase, economist at Columbia, or it's called NATO or the International Economic Bureaucracy or G7 or G3 or sometimes more realistically G1. From a more fundamental point of view, we could describe it as an array of mega corporations often linked to one another by strategic alliances, which administer the global economy. That includes the interchanges that are misleadingly called trade, in a kind of global mercantilism with tendencies towards oligopoly in most sectors, heavily reliant on the state sector to create the dynamic components of the economy, to socialize costs and risks, and to subdue recalcitrant elements. Kind of a mouthful, but I think it's a fairly accurate first approximation to what we might call really existing globalization. The issues of sovereignty and freedom arise in two domains, dramatically so in the last year. One domain has to do with sovereign right to be free from military intervention. Here the questions arise in a world order based on sovereign states. The second category has to do with the right to be free to follow one's own path in the face of socioeconomic intervention. Here the questions arise in the framework of the corporate mercantilism that's linked to state power and the international bureaucracies. And in both domains, for obvious reasons, the dominant role is that of the United States. Both of these kinds of issues have been lively and contentious in the past year. Because of time limits, I'll say only a few words about the military political intervention, reluctantly. There's a lot to say about it, and then I'll turn to some comments on the other. With regard to the issue of military intervention and sovereignty, the last year has been quite an interesting and in some ways unusual one. From early 1999, just about a year ago, there has been a remarkable chorus of self-adulation of a kind rarely seen outside totalitarian states, having to do with NATO's bombing of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. These are just a few representative quotes from the mainstream and leading figures. This was regarded as a landmark in international relations, opening a new era in which the enlightened states will use force where they believe it to be just, disregarding the restrictive old rules like the UN Charter in favor of modern notions of justice that they will fashion. The enlightened states, we're told, are led by an idealistic new world bent on ending inhumanity, namely the United States, which is now at the height of its glory, opposed only by the defiant, the indolent, and the miscreant, the disorderly elements of the world. That's roughly the worldview within the enlightened states. No particular criterion is offered as to how you join the club, apparently, but it's kind of self-anointed enlightened states. Outside the club, the circle of enlightened states, the picture was quite different. It's kind of interesting that little of it was reported here, but one can find it. There's a very broad range of opinion outside of Europe and the United States. Its main perspective was probably captured rather accurately by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who gets quoted here when he says the right kind of things, but not this time. He described what he called the aggressors as opening a new era in which might is right. If the protection of the oppressed was their real concern, they could have been defending, for example, the miserable Kurds. He says, for example, because it's only one case, though a rather revealing one. A leading military strategic analyst in Israel described the new era as a return to the colonial era. The use of force, as in the colonial era, is cloaked in moralistic righteousness. He described the enlightened states as a danger to the world, warned that their actions are going to lead to nuclear and other kinds of proliferation because others will simply have to develop weapons of mass destruction to defend themselves against the predatory powers that are now out of control, facing no deterrent. Similar views were quite widely expressed throughout a good part of the world, most of it, in fact. Solzhenitsyn's reference to the miserable Kurds is quite appropriate. He was speaking just about at the time when NATO was commemorating its 50th anniversary in Washington last April. It wasn't a celebration because the meeting was held under the somber shadow of ethnic cleansing right across the borders of NATO. It took rather impressive discipline for the participants in the meeting and commentators on it not to notice that some of the worst ethnic cleansing of the 90s was within NATO, not across its borders, namely in the southeastern part of NATO, where just in the Clinton years, 2 to 3 million people were made refugees, tens of thousands killed, 3,500 villages destroyed. That's seven times Kosovo under NATO bombing. All of this was relied significantly on a huge flow of arms from the United States, escalating as the atrocities peaked through the Clinton years. But somehow that was missed. The difference of judgment about the enlightened states was actually being put to a rather clear test exactly at the time that the fine words were pouring out in such an impressive stream. So while the enlightened states and their educated elites were praising themselves for their astonishing humanism, they had a very good opportunity to apply the modern notions of justice that they were fashioning to end inhumanity, and it's instructive to see how they did so. In November, this is the second major atrocity that reached prominence in 1999. In November 1988, new contingents of the Indonesian commandos, Kopassus commandos, who are renowned for their bravery, sadism and brutality, and had just emerged from new U.S. training, Operation Iron Balance, in 1998, which was conducted more or less in secret because it was in violation of congressional intention and legislation. They entered East Timor along with about 5,000 new recruits, and in February 1999, they initiated a military operation, Operation Clean Sweep, which was an operation designed to murder, destroy, intimidate, which they did on a vast scale, including major massacres. The most famous of them may be the massacre in Liquisa, where maybe 50 or 60 people were murdered in a church in which they'd taken refuge in April. According to rather credible church sources in East Timor, they had killed about 3,000 to 5,000 people just in the first months of the year, from February through July, more later. And they were giving very clear and explicit warnings, which took a lot of effort to miss, that much worse was going to come after the referendum scheduled for August, if the population voted for independence. With astonishing bravery, the population did vote for independence. Virtually everyone voted, about 80% for independence, although they were totally defenseless and at the mercy of the Indonesian forces, the U.S. armed and trained Indonesian forces, and the paramilitaries that they organized. Shortly after that, about 85% of the population was brutally driven from their homes, that 750,000 people, and the country was mostly destroyed, and a quarter of a million or so were driven into Indonesian territory, where about 150,000 still remain in concentration camps that have limited access. Notice that in this case, there was no issue of sovereignty. These are atrocities going on where there's no question of sovereignty. Indonesia's sovereign rights in East Timor were comparable to those of Nazi Germany and occupied France. Indonesia had invaded in 1975. It had been ordered at once by the Security Council to withdraw immediately. The United States actually voted for that resolution, but it was meaningless for reasons explained by the U.S. ambassador, U.N. ambassador Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who wrote his memoirs a couple of years afterwards, and explained in words that should be memorized by anyone who takes their freedom seriously. Moynihan explained that though the U.S. voted for the U.N. resolution, the State Department wanted things to turn out as they did, and my instructions, he said, were to render the United Nations utterly ineffective in anything it might do, instructions which I carried out, he says, with considerable success.
Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, speaking recently at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. We'll be back with his speech on globalization in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers, as we return now to Professor Noam Chomsky. This weekend, major protests in South Korea around an international Asian summit. And Noam Chomsky continues by talking about globalization.
Because of these facts, that's the reason why about a century ago, in all the industrial societies, financial markets were regulated because they were just leading to total catastrophe. But the regulation that was instituted internal to countries is rejected by the Washington consensus in the international arena. That's a major problem today, well recognized even in the economic report of the president, though there are, again, are beneficiaries, primarily financial institutions. The tendencies described by the Volcker Commission and UNCTAD are also discussed in a lot of technical studies. There's variation. One can't be certain about anything as poorly understood as the international economy, very poorly understood. But it's reasonably clear that the dismantling of the Bretton Woods system in the mid-70s led to a decline in the deterioration of virtually all macroeconomic indicators. Growth of the economy, growth of productivity, capital investment all slowed. Interest rates are far higher, which slows the economic growth and also fluctuate much more, increases instability, undermines investment. Financial crises have increased with severe human cost. Wages have stagnated or declined, while workloads have increased. That's particularly striking in the United States, where real hourly wages for the majority of workers, non-supervisory workers, are more than 10% below what they were in the mid-70s, which is kind of astonishing. This usually continually goes up. And the workload has increased to the highest in the industrial world. Global inequality has greatly increased. That's well known. The most dramatic figures are not among countries, rather within the global population. There's a recent study by a World Bank economist, which just carries it up to the mid-90s, who points out if you take the top 5% and the bottom 5% of the global population, their ratio of wealth was about roughly 80 to 1 in 1988, and it went up to 114 to 1 in 1994, and it's been increasing steadily since. The standard measure of inequality, the so-called Gini coefficient, has reached the highest level for the global population that's on record for any population in the past. The beneficiaries of this system commonly argue that it doesn't really matter very much if the you know, if inequality grows, as long since the economy is raising all the boats. First of all, that's false. It matters quite a lot. Inequality turns out to have very severe effects. But apart from being false, it's irrelevant because most of the boats are sinking or barely staying afloat by paddling a lot harder. The period pre and post mid-1970s is quite commonly called by economists, many economists call the earlier period up to the mid-70s a golden age of, you know, very high growth and increase of social benefits and so on, followed from the mid-70s by what they call a leaden age. That's true even by conventional measures. The steady improvements that should be expected as a matter of course have either slowed or reversed, apart from highly privileged sectors, which in the rich countries is a lot of people. Not the majority, but a lot. The situation is much worse if you look at measures that matter for human life, like the social indices, index of social health, and much worse when you look at the poorer countries. Well, there are a number of crucial indices that aren't discussed in the Fordham study. Let me mention a couple. One of them is insecurity, which results from what's called technically labor market flexibility. The World Bank a couple of years ago in a development report pointed out that, I'm quoting, labor market flexibility has received a bad name as a euphemism for pushing wages down and workers out. Actually, it's received that bad name because that's exactly what it is. But they say that nevertheless, despite the bad name, labor market flexibility is essential in all regions of the world. The most important reforms involve lifting constraints on labor mobility and on wage flexibility and breaking the ties between social services and labor contracts. That last phrase means dismantling the improvements in the quality of life that have been won over many generations of hard and bitter struggle. That has to be reversed. When they talk about increasing labor mobility, they're not referring to the foundations of free trade theory as described by Adam Smith, who pointed out that free trade is based crucially on free movement of labor, free distribution of labor. They're not calling for that. That's out of the question. What they mean by increasing labor mobility is increasing the possibility of kicking people out of their jobs. When they talk about increasing wage flexibility, they mean flexibility down, not up, except for a small number of people, where it goes way up. The importance of all of this is quite widely recognized. Alan Greenspan, his testimony about the economy to Congress, pointed out that greater worker insecurity, his phrase, greater worker insecurity, he said, is an important factor in the health of the economy. It keeps inflation down. That's the most important thing for banks and so on. And the reason it keeps inflation down is because workers are just afraid. They're afraid to ask for wages and benefits while profits continue to soar to heights that are described as dazzling and stupendous. Actually, the business press has run out of adjectives years ago. And all of this improves the health of the economy by a certain criterion. How do you achieve all these beneficial results? Well, one is flexibility of labor markets, that is the threat of firing. But there are other measures. So take, say, NAFTA. One effect of NAFTA, which was studied by a good labor historian, Kate Bronfenbrenner, Cornell, in a study that was carried out under NAFTA rules because of labor opposition is what was happening, she discovered that the threat of job transfer has been used to break organizing efforts in about 50% of cases, which is quite high, and that when organizing efforts nevertheless succeeded, the number of actual transfers tripled after NAFTA, but of course in the mobile industries like manufacturing, not construction. Well, all that's illegal, of course, but doesn't make any difference. I mean, when there's a criminal state, it doesn't make any difference if actions are illegal. State corporate collusion in criminal activities has other beneficial effects for the economy. So during the Reagan years, illegal firing of union organizers went up very fast, about triple. Also, industrial accidents went up very fast, almost doubled, because the OSHA regulations simply weren't enforced. And that helps the corporate sector. So this was actually reported in some detail in Business Week, only place I've seen an account. All of this helps destroy unions, and destroying unions leads to the essential reforms, namely increasing labor market flexibility with all of its good consequences. Apart from everything else, there's a kind of a psychic effect, which is hard to measure, but it's undoubtedly severe to loss of security. And I suspect that it's finding its way into the social indicators. So, for example, into indicators like the sharp increase in child abuse or child poverty, which is unusually high in the United States and is a form of severe child abuse. Well, there are other important effects of the contemporary form of globalization instituted by state corporate power in the past 25 years. One significant aspect is undermining popular sovereignty and substantive democracy, and that's very significant and understood. The Bretton Woods system, instituted by the United States and Britain primarily in the mid-40s, regulated basically was based on regulation of exchange rates. It didn't fluctuate a lot. And also permitting countries to restrict capital flow. And there were very good reasons for that. And those reasons were explicit. They were explained and are well understood. The reason is that if free capital flow is allowed, that creates what's called a virtual parliament of concentrated global capital, which can exercise veto power over national policies that it considers irrational. It can exercise veto power simply by the threat of capital flight, which is unsustainable and leads to depression and so on. Well, what kind of policies are irrational? Essentially those that help people rather than profits. So labor rights, education, health, stimulating the economy, those things, they can be vetoed by the virtual parliament if capital flight is free. And that was understood, very clearly understood. In the mid-1940s, when this system was instituted, there was enormous popular support in the United States and elsewhere for social democratic and even more radical democratic measures. And the Bretton Woods system responded to that popular mood, a mood, incidentally, which the business world regarded with very great concern. The National Association of Manufacturers warned that the greatest hazard facing industrialists is the rising political power of the masses. They generally use kind of vulgar Marxist rhetoric. It's not uncommon. The values are reversed, but the assumptions are the same. That led to an enormous corporate offensive to undermine the threat of democracy in the post-war period. That's been fairly well studied and should be better known. There's good academic work on it. The essential point lying behind all this was brought out in a kind of a dry academic way in a very highly regarded history of the international monetary system by Barry Eichengreen. Like others, he points out that the current period of globalization, so-called, is rather like the pre-World War I period by gross measures. A lot of gross measures look similar. But there are some differences. And one crucial difference, he points out, has to do with democracy, with popular sovereignty. Quote him, pre-World War I, government policy had not yet been politicized by universal male suffrage, the rise of trade unionism, and parliamentary labor parties. So therefore, the very severe human costs of what's called financial rectitude that are imposed by the virtual parliament, it could be transferred to the general population who were defenseless. But that luxury was no longer available in the more democratic post-World War II period, and therefore at Bretton Woods, limits on capital mobility substituted for limits on democracy as a source of insulation from market pressures. That captures it pretty accurately, I think. There's also a corollary namely dismantling of the post-war economic system since the mid-70s, has led to a significant attack on substantive democracy, which in fact has happened, not only in the industrial countries, but rather strikingly in the South. There, the effect is enormous. In fact, for about half the population of the South, the developing countries, so-called, they don't even have control over national economic and social programs. Those are designed by the international bureaucracy under conditionalities imposed by the IMF, which are related to the so-called debt. I say so-called because the debt is not a simple economic fact. In large measure, it's an ideological construction. Looks quite different when you view it as an economic fact, though. Explain what I mean if you like, but it's late, so I'll stop. The principle of undermining popular sovereignty extends much more deeply than this. A lot of general popular discontent about what's going on was revealed rather dramatically and importantly at Seattle, and probably will be again in Washington in a couple of weeks. But the basic issues were, in my opinion, brought out much more clearly and sharply in Montreal in late January. In Montreal, there was an international conference in late January to try to reach what's called a biosafety treaty, biosafety protocol. Quote from the New York Times, so you know I'm not misleading you. According to the New York Times account, a rather ambiguous compromise was reached after intense negotiations that often pitted the United States against almost everyone else. What was at issue is what's called the precautionary principle. The European Union, which was on the other side, which is why there was a compromise, it was only the third world on the other side, they just get smashed. But in this time, there were two power blocks opposing, so there was a compromise. The European Union defined the precautionary principle like this: countries must have the freedom, the sovereign right, to take precautionary measures with regard to genetically altered organisms that they feel might be harmful. Now, that means seed, microbes, animals, and crops. The United States opposed that. It insisted on the World Trade Organization rules, which are, quoting, "an import can be banned only on the basis of scientific evidence, usually called sound scientific evidence. Whether there is sound scientific evidence will be determined in a secret panel by representatives of the corporate world." So in brief, the world, and this is the fundamental principle of the World Trade Organization, the principle is that people must be denied the right to say, "I don't want to be an experimental subject." Actually, some of the uglier chapters of the history of medicine have to do with the denial of that right to defenseless people, to slaves, to poor women, to ethnic minorities, and so on. But that has recently changed. Now, at least in principle, it's necessary to get consent forms before you carry out experiments with human subjects. So, for example, if, say, somebody from the Johns Hopkins Medical School walks in here and says, "Look, you guys are going to be experimental subjects in an experiment I'm carrying out where I'm going to give you some new drug, or I'm going to stick an electrode in your brain or something or other, and see what happens." According to present rules, you're allowed to say, "No, I'm sorry, I don't want to be an experimental subject." But according to World Trade Organization rules, you don't have that right. You would first have to provide sound scientific evidence to be judged in secret by a panel of corporate representatives that the experiment is going to harm you. And unless you can provide that evidence, you must be an experimental subject. Okay? You have no right. That's the rule. And that was the issue. For the general population, that right has to be abrogated. That is, they must be experimental subjects so that U.S.-based corporations can achieve dazzling profits, thanks in large part to very large public subsidies and the protectionist devices that are also a crucial part of the World Trade Organization regime. Actually, these same issues, if you think them through, arise with regard to the so-called externalities that are dismissed. So unless there is sound scientific evidence that environmental or ecological effects are harmful, then the population of the world must be experimental subjects, as well as future generations that have no vote in the market. That is, international conventions must be kept as weak as possible and ignored as much as possible, unless you can provide sound scientific evidence that you experimental subjects are going to be harmed. You don't have a right to say, I don't want to try. You know, that's again a crucial principle, based on the underlying principle that the rights of people are incidental, and the rights of profit and power to highly concentrated private tyrannies, which unaccountable private tyrannies, which what they are paramount. Those are supreme values, often disguised as trade, but that's not the issue. Well, there are, of course, beneficiaries to all of this, to these specific forms of socio-political and economic organization that are misleadingly called globalization. Among the beneficiaries are those conducting the experiments and relying on the concentration of power to impose them on others. Included also are those who are writing in praise of the institutional structure, its policies, its leaders, just as they're also praising the leaders of the enlightened states for their virtue and magnificence. The beneficiaries include most of us and the circles in which we spend most of our lives. And for the same reasons, we have unusual power. That power provides opportunities, it offers choices, and we can hardly fail to understand that the choices we make will have very substantial human consequences today and for future generations. Thanks.
Professor Noam Chomsky speaking at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Chomsky is a professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, speaking about the issue of globalization as protests continue to erupt around the world, the latest this past weekend in South Korea around corporate globalization. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and John Sellers is with us with the Ruckus Society. He is one of the protesters from Philadelphia who was hit with a $1 million bail and now faces trial. When will that trial be?
The prosecution just recently last Wednesday asked for a continuance. And they have now scheduled the trial for November 14th.
And what are you charged with?
I'm charged with something like 14 counts altogether. There's 9 original charges and then 5 counts of conspiracy on top of that, all misdemeanors.
How can misdemeanors end up with a $1 million bail?
That was a mystery to most people with any kind of real knowledge of the criminal system. You know, bail is set to ensure that people return for their court dates. It has nothing to do with any kind of punitive measures, supposedly. But obviously, this bail was set to keep me in jail. It was set egregiously high for hundreds of people to keep them in Philadelphia prisons, to keep them off the streets where they were practicing free speech, and to keep them specifically out of L.A.
And did it work?
Well, It definitely kept people in jail for a significant amount of time. Most people were in jail for a week or over a week for, you know, what amounted to misdemeanor charges. So that was very strange and very egregious kind of treatment of people. And obviously it was a sign that our message was very radical, and something that people wanted to criminalize was the message that we had.
So what have you learned as you prepare for the trial? What information has come out about what happened in Philadelphia?
Well, a lot of very disconcerting information has come out about the surveillance on behalf of the Pennsylvania State Police, the kind of covert operations that law enforcement was engaging in, the underhanded nature of many of the tactics that they used, the illegal seizure of the warehouse where many of the puppets and banners and political messages were being prepared for the actions against the prison industrial complex and the institutional racism of the criminal justice system. And so, you know, I think that we are seeing the criminalization of dissent, of free speech, of people that have an unpopular message with regards to the status quo and the reigning power structure. And we're seeing, you know, some tactics that probably a lot of people haven't seen since the McCarthy era, you know, and a lot of the information that's come out in discovery in the trials reads like stuff out of the McCarthy era, connecting NGOs here in the United States to leftist revolutionary governments around the world, the former Soviet bloc countries, the trade unions of all things, nefarious trade unions. So, I mean, this is stuff that reads like red baiting, and it's really scary to think that, you know, these people can vilify, you know, good folks, civil society that really wants to enhance democracy in this country.
Can you be more specific what exactly you found?
Well, one of the most disconcerting things that has come out are reports by a nefarious organization called the Malden Group that to any kind of scrutiny seems to be some original members of the John Birch Society, of all things, that is a far right-wing think tank that is offering unsolicited dossiers on non-governmental organizations working against corporate globalization. And they are, providing, you know, multi-jurisdictional law enforcement agencies with intelligence, you know, very, very, I would say erroneous intelligence on these non-governmental organizations, vilifying us, stereotyping us, and marginalizing us. And in many of the sealed affidavits, or several of the sealed affidavits coming out of Philadelphia, we see law enforcement quoting this, you know, this Malden Group as if it were a government agency, you know, as if it were fact.
Where is it based?
That's, your guess is as good as mine, Amy. It's they don't have a website. They don't really seem to have an address. I don't know that much about them. I haven't been able to read the Malden report. I've only seen the quotation of the Malden Group in one of the sealed affidavits for the search and seizure of the puppet space itself. But there, we do now have our attorneys now have the Malden report in their hands, and I think it'll be really interesting to go through there and also to get a lot more information, start doing some digging on our side of the fence to see who the Malden Group is and what motivates them.
And who exactly were they saying that groups here, nonprofits, NGOs, were connected to?
Well, they talk about obviously the Ruckus Society. They talk about a number of the other organizations, a number of the other organizing groups around the R2K, the Philly DAG collectives.
Direct Action Group.
Yes, the Philadelphia Direct Action Group, Philadelphia ACT UP, a number of different organizations of great standing, and organizations full of people of conscience that are working for a better, you know, a better country and a better planet.
And will the court just accept information from any group like that? a name, or its name, but not knowing where it's from?
Well, it's interesting you'd ask, because that sealed affidavit did make it past some judge sitting on the bench in Philadelphia. The Philadelphia Police Department was granted the legal rights to search and seize that warehouse, and they arrested upwards of 75 people before they even had a chance to practice free speech in the streets of Philadelphia, as is their constitutional right. You're seeing surgical preemptive strikes against our constitutional First Amendment.
Was the Malden Group information given to the police before the raiding of the conversion space, the puppet space?
Yes, it was actually in the affidavit that the police gave to the judge to justify seizing and searching the puppet space. So that affidavit was then sealed because the police said that it was it represented imminent risk of harm to the officers that were operating undercover, the Pennsylvania State Police. They said they would risk their lives if they had been outed to a bunch of nonviolent activists and exposed as police officers. And so they were able to seal that affidavit for, I think, 3 or 4 weeks. When it was finally opened, we got to see what was inside it, and it's incredible.
We're talking to John Sellers of the Ruckus Society, which is one of the groups that has really helped organize protesters in Seattle and Philadelphia and Los Angeles. And one of the things they do is have training camps for activists. What are the training camps to come?
Well, in January, we're going to help a lot of folks from the Tibetan support community to put on a Free Tibet camp that we're very excited about. And then we have a very full year next year. We're looking in March at an alternative spring break action camp in Florida, Spank the Bank action camp, centered around the emerging campaign against Citigroup, and as well as the World Bank. So both public and private financial institutions and how they operate as engines of corporate globalization. And then we're looking at a camp in May around biotech and preparing activists that want to nonviolently confront this consortium of biotech industries that will be meeting in San Diego in June of next year. And then further on down the road, next fall, we'll be looking at eGenius Action Camp, which will be for digital activists looking at all kinds of different solutions for a number of different tactics that activists can use to really get their work and their struggles out to a much broader audience, expanding the circle of people that are witnessing these actions. And we're very excited about that.
When you talk about an alternative spring break in Florida, what actually happens at a camp like this?
Well, we'd like to think that that we're on the cutting edge of both the debauchery of spring break and some good, clean, fun for folks to have on spring break, and doing some real significant political work at the same time. That it's going to be much more fun than most of the vacuous spring breaks that occur, but also politically very poignant. And we're going to invite the vanguard of college activists to that camp and really bring people together for a cutting-edge experience.
But what happens at the camp? I mean, in terms of all of these camps, where do people stay? What do people do during the day?
Well, it is a camp in the best sense of that word. People are camping. We set up a fully functional field kitchen and really feed people amazing gourmet vegan and vegetarian food. We have workshops going on all day, from theoretical workshops in traditional nonviolence training and media skills and direct action planning and strategy, community organizing, political theater. And then we have a lot of hands-on, very physical training in climbing for urban areas, climbing for wilderness, forest defense, blockading roads and buildings, And then we do a lot of panels and discussions at night on very significant issues. And really, you know, we're going to tailor this camp specifically to public and private financial institutions and how they drive this global corporate juggernaut that is destroying so much of the planet that we love.
Why Citibank?
Well, Citibank is arguably the largest financial institution in the United States. They have a hand in so many of the most nefarious, extractive kind of undertakings around the planet. They are one of the biggest supporters of the privatization of the prison industry. And they're also redlining a number of communities, more marginalized communities, specifically communities of color in urban areas, for any kind of lending and any kind of financial influx into those communities. So in many ways, the Citigroup is one of the driving engines behind globalization, and is can be looked upon by a number of different divergent activist communities as a common adversary to hopefully bring a number of different communities together around a specific discrete target.
Your trial that you face and the very high bail that was set for you, has that changed what you're able to do now?
No, I don't think so. I think that the charges are so outrageous and so fraudulent that I haven't had to concern myself too much about them. I have a great lawyer. You know, I'm much more concerned about the 400 people that I was arrested with. A number of them are facing felony charges. There are 30 people that are facing, more than 30 people that are facing multiple felony charges that are, you know, facing decades of their lives, you know, young people facing decades of their lives in jail for acts that they didn't commit, and are facing fraudulent charges. Specifically, many of them are facing aggravated assault on police officers, and so they are kind of he said, cases, or he said, she said cases against, you know, some of Philadelphia's finest, who are going to have a lot of stature, and their testimony is going to carry a lot of weight in Philadelphia courts, and a number of other ridiculous charges, organizing a riot, and stuff that references catastrophe. I mean, really ridiculous charges. And, you know, these people are literally fighting for decades of their lives, and they, we don't know how those trials are going to turn out until we see them through. And there are hundreds of people staying in solidarity in the courts in Philadelphia with them, people that could have left the judicial system. They were offered some pretty I would say sweet deals by the Philadelphia legal authorities, and they opted to stay in the system, to go to trial, to face trial, to exonerate themselves, and to also make sure that the eyes of the world watch these very significant cases.
Last question is, when, for listeners to remember what happened to you, you were in Philadelphia. How were you picked up?
Well, I was walking down the street in Philadelphia the day after the mass actions, walking away from an area where there was a lot of media. I saw that I was being videotaped by Philadelphia Police Department, and was literally just, kind of walking away, minding my own business, and was picked up off the street by a whole plethora of Philadelphia's finest, and then charged with a bunch of stuff that's just outrageous.
And your Palm Pilot and cell phone?
Actually, my Palm Pilot was safe in my in the apartment that I was staying in. My cell phone and Swiss Army knife were taken as implements of crime.
And how long were you held in jail?
I was held in Philadelphia's jails for about 6.5 days.
Well, John Sellers of Ruckus Society, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sid Rock Franklin.